from WXXI News. This is Connections, broadcasting with a live audience at the Little Theater in Rochester. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made on Sunday, September 17th, when PBS and WXXI-TV debut the first of 10 parts of a new documentary series from Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. The film series is called simply The Vietnam War. Burns has said that after exhaustively telling the stories of several previous wars, he thought he was done with the genre. But Novick and Burns came to believe that now is the time to examine Vietnam comprehensively. They say that we tend to need a generation or so after the end of a war before we can look back and fully, properly evaluate what happened, what went right, what went wrong, what lessons we need to consider. Today we are broadcasting from the Little Theater to share a range of perspectives. Throughout these 2 hours, you will hear audience comments and questions. You can join the program toll-free at 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. And you can email the program at connections@wxxi.org. Our guests are here to share their own views of what they experienced and what we can learn. This hour, joining me on the Little Theater stage are Captain John White, a U.S. Marine Corps veteran. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Evan.
Also here with us is... Sure, everyone here deserves applause. It's great to have all of them here. Alan Levin is better known as Brother Weeze. He's a U.S. Army veteran. And Brother Weeze, welcome to the program.
Thanks, sir. Thank you.
And hello to Henrietta and Max Levine. They are activists, and they are not just activists here to tell their story of what was going on a generation ago, but I think their perspective is lifelong activists, and it's great to have both of you. Max, Henrietta, thank you for being here. I'd like to start this hour listening to what one of the co-directors, Lynn Novick, said on this program just a few weeks ago. So let's listen to, in her words, why now? Why go back and look at Vietnam at this point when, let's face it, there have been books written, there have been many commentaries, there have been films. Why do 18 hours now? Here's what Lynn Novick told us.
We usually want 25 years at least before we have any perspective on an event that would take us from the realm of journalism into the realm of history. When you're in the middle of something, it's very hard to know what's actually going on. But it's also because it was so traumatic and so complex and it didn't end the way we hoped and there was so much bad feeling and bitterness about it, so much pain that we never really took a hard look at what happened and why and who we should blame for what happened and what went wrong.
That's co-director Lynn Novick. So again, set your DVRs or get ready to join us on WXXI-TV starting Sunday, September 17th, 8 p.m. And then it's 2 weeks. It's Sunday through Thursday nights at 8 p.m., 10 parts over 2 weeks. And it's going to be a remarkable event, no doubt about it. But I want to ask our guests if they agree with what we just heard from Lynn Novick. John White, when she says she thinks we needed this time to kind of step back and now go back and reassess with a little time and distance, do you agree? How do you feel about that?
I do agree. I think for all of us who served in combat in Vietnam, it takes a pretty considerable amount of time to put that in a place where you've got some perspective, because otherwise it's purely personal. And I was proud to enlist. I was proud to serve. I was proud to be a captain of Marines, and I'm proud of the fact that I was in Vietnam. It was a very significant experience for me. But I do think that you bury it, and it was really just a few years ago. It was Pittsford Southern High School, and a history teacher asked me to come in and share some thoughts about Vietnam from somebody or to his classroom. And that was kind of the first time I ever really started to talk about it. It was just way down deep. So I agree. It takes time to gain perspective. Otherwise, it's purely personal.
And John, on the ways it becomes personal, you've said in previous interviews, and I'd like to just explore a little bit of this now, when you were serving, you said, you know, in some ways you were almost trained to hate the enemy, and that there was a Marine Corps reunion at Quantico, I think, that, you know, you kind of have this moment where you can look back and say, no, there's some shared humanity, and we, you know, that can change over time. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think there's actually a transition. You are trained to hate the enemy. Otherwise, it's very, very difficult to do what you have to do. But beyond the training, and this sounds very harsh, I shared this with the high school kids, and the reaction was pretty significant, is you become your own hater of the enemy. And when you find your own colleagues, when you find these young kids that are serving, doing well, inspirational in terms of their commitment, and you watch them and you lose them, I think the thing that mentally had me survive was the ability to hate the enemy.
And has that changed with that time and distance from the war?
Actually, that has changed, and it only changed, Evan, as you mentioned, the Marine Corps reunion. We had an officers' reunion of all of us that trained together and served together in Vietnam. And I've spent the last 49 years hating the Vietnamese and not having anything to do with them, Vietnamese products, Vietnamese food, whatever it happened to be. A year and a half ago, I was at Quantico. We were at the basic school, which is a training. It's not basic training. It's in the Marine Corps. Basic school is a 6-month advanced infantry program for officers. And we were sitting there having lunch at the basic school in the mess hall there. And a captain, one of the instructors at the basic school, came over and sat with us. He asked if he minded if he shared some thoughts with us. On his name tag, on his uniform, he was Captain Pham. He said, obviously, I'm a Vietnamese. He said, I know you're all Vietnam vets. I want to share a story with you. My mother was badly wounded and burned with napalm in her village during a conflict, and the Marine Corps actually saved her life. The Marines actually evacuated her. They treated her, and she became on the base, on the fire base where she was, she actually became not really an employee, but an assistive participant with the Marine Corps. She needed significant surgery not available in Vietnam, and the Marine Corps arranged for her to fly back to the United States and have that surgery. He was born in the United States, and because of the commitment that the Marine Corps made to his mother and saved his family, he made the commitment that he would not only join the Marine Corps, he would become an officer, and he would make that his dedicated career for life. That changed my perspective 100%.
Remarkable. Brother Weiss, from your perspective, Lynn Novick saying that we needed this time and that this is the right time for a comprehensive review. Do you agree with that?
Of course I agree with it, but just hearing the captain speak and everything that's happened to me today, to me the whole thing was personal. I was a young boy. I spent my 20th and 21st birthdays in Vietnam, and I didn't go there for any political reason. I just went there because a buddy of mine went, something happened to him, and I was a kid, and I went. And the strangest thing happened today when I showed up here to do this show with you. I understood that there were two veterans and two protesters going to be here, which is a strange thing for me because not only am I a 3-time veteran, but I also was in the Vietnam Veterans Against the War after I came back. But I was interested to see what happened. So I come in here, and I said, well, who are the protesters? They said these old Max and Henrietta Levine. And I went, you got to be bullshmitting me.
Well, first of all, Brother
Schmidt, I said, my brother.
Thank you.
I said, Schmidt.
We do have a delay. Also, nobody called Max and Henrietta old. You.
Wait a minute, you're worried. Where am I?
Go ahead, Brother Weiss.
They're 96 and 98 years old over here.
Well,
but let me
and they have stories to share. Go ahead, yeah. You got it. You got it.
Let me finish, please. These are the people. These were my second parents. I'm coming here today, and I say, who are the protesters? And they said, they go, do you know them? I go, do I know them? These are my people. And let me tell you something. I hope she remembers the day I left to go away on the bus. Henrietta came down and said, don't go, don't go. Is that right, Henrietta? Do you remember? She's shaking her head. We're on the radio. Not radio. Anyways, the whole Vietnam thing for me is a really, really, really different story. I'll tell you the truth. I hated the Vietnamese until I ate at Mama San's, and I went, oh, my God, this food is phenomenal. He doesn't like the bit. But anyways, in all honesty, I mean, it was an unbelievable growing experience. I went 3 times, not for any good reasons. Actually, the last time I went, I did it all with a Puerto Rican friend of mine from New York City who was in my infantry outfit. And when I went the 3rd time, I thought maybe I was going to take somebody else's place, even one guy, because I had a little game going. And if I could take another guy's place, I thought it would be interesting. And my perspective, of course, is very much different than Captain White, and I respect everything he's done. And when I came back, I was in the Vietnam Veterans Against the War for a short period of time, similar to the John Kerry. And I have to say this last thing. I sent some of the Levine's friends a little tape from the woods in Vietnam. They sent me one of those little tape recorders that you used to see on Mission Impossible, the little open reel battery run. And we made this tape and we sent it back. And then after I was back in Rochester, 20 years later, one of these guys still had the tape. Long story short, we put it on a CD and I play it on my radio show once like every Memorial Day or Veterans Day. And I believe that if I didn't have those tapes, lots of guys would say, you were never in Vietnam. If I have these unbelievable tapes that also explain a lot of things by 20 and 21-year-old guys that John Kerry told people. I could go on forever. Take someone else.
We'll have plenty more to say this hour, Brother Weiss. I want to turn to Max and Henrietta Levine, who, yes, it's true. They're 98 and 96 years old and have really dedicated so much of their energy to these causes. Max, let me start with you and ask you, have your feelings on Vietnam changed at all since the war ended?
Let me run this over the crowd here. Weasel sent a letter to us back when he was in Vietnam, and he described the horror of war when at night you'd hear noises, you'd pick up your gun and shoot at the noises, and the noises were animals that were prized animals as far as the Vietnamese were concerned. It just gave you the picture of what was going on in the minds of young men who were then conscripted to go to war. You asked the question of me. I was against the war from the start. I was one of the people who said that Johnson lied to the American people. And the proof of the pudding is that years later, through the investigations of Congress, we found that it was a big lie. And the whole war could have been prevented. Ho Chi Minh at that time, when it was Vietnam, had talked to Eisenhower about changing his attitude about the war, and it didn't go well. And Kennedy came along, and my thoughts about that are that he was assassinated by the CIA because of his actions that he had taken against, or at least I thought that he had taken against the war. So yes, I was against the war.
And it sounds like that has not changed. No. Henrietta, for you, there was a moment in preparing for today's program in which a lot of tremendous people worked hard to bring this outstanding panel with diverse viewpoints here and did a lot of what we call pre-interviewing or other conversations. And I was reading some of the notes and I was struck that you and Max have said that you feel like there's a certain sadness that you get to this age and you wonder if things have gone in a positive or if the progress that you might have hoped for in your youth has been achieved. And I wonder if you can tell me a little bit how you feel about that, particularly now as we look back at Vietnam and war in general.
Well, in the first place, I would say that what is going on currently with our president and North Korea makes me very nervous. Back in 1961, I was part of a group of women nationwide who called themselves Women Strike for Peace. We wanted the government to stop testing nuclear weapons at that time because we felt that our children could be harmed by the fallout. Within 2 years, our group was already calling for the United States to get out of Vietnam. And of course, just as I look out at the audience here, probably half of you were for the war and half of you against the war. But the idea was that we had asked the government to stop testing, and then came upon the idea that the United States was already involved in the Vietnam War. Our first thought was not our sons, not your sons, and not their sons. And we've worked on that to try to get the United States to do something about the draft calls. You know, the poor people in our country were more affected by draft calls than middle class and upper class people. But our point of view was no more men for Vietnam. We used to go to the draft board, pick at the draft board, call special meetings for downtown, and you know, from 4:30 to 5:30, something like that. And we did persist in saying no more men for Vietnam. And that built an anti-war movement at that time that was quite significant. And one of the things that we built up to, of course, it went all through the 60s, but in May of 67, we called a demonstration at Midtown in Rochester. We didn't ask for permission from the city. We just said we are going to close off Main Street and protest this war. Over 1,000 people came out that day, and what happened was five women had to cross hands to close off the street from in front of
Sibley's.
What's the
Sibley's.
Name of the store?
Sibley's.
Sibley's. That whole block was closed off. At the end of the demonstration, the police arrested 100 men, no women at that time. This was before the women's movement, except for our group. Anyway, one of the men who was arrested that day was my husband, of 100 people. My husband at that time was a representative of a manufacturing company. So he was dressed in a suit and a tie, and he was picked up with this other 99 people. He was in his cell, I don't know what they call it, and saw the cot. And Max is a very relaxed sort of guy. He likes to take a nap. So he rolled up his jacket and made a pillow of it. They had already taken his belt, his tie, you know, anything he could have used to damage himself, and stretched out on the little cot that is in the different prisons, the different cells. Pretty soon, two policemen came along, and they looked in, and, you know, this was a rather strange-looking protester. So they said, what's he in there for? And the other policeman said, his wife went to Cuba. And it's true, I had gone to Cuba with this group, Women Strike for Peace. And when we were in Cuba, the Federation of Cuban Women had invited women from Vietnam. And I'll never forget that luncheon, sharing it with the women from Vietnam and the American women and the women from Cuba. But what occurs to me now is that we are being sort of pushed into another war situation. And unless we find voices to say no, it could happen. Because if any of you have watched the last 2 weeks of our president's speeches or whatever you want to call them, you know that everything with him is so extemporaneous, and I think that we do have to worry about his hand on the nuclear numbers. Vietnam, for some of us, we picketed, we drafted, and we urged young men not to go to the draft, but refuse to serve. And many of them did. Some went to Canada. Some just refused to serve and were conscientious objectors. And I think it was a very difficult time for young men in our nation, and thousands of coffins that came back of dead soldiers who fought in a war that we had no business being in, because North and South Korea were going to work out their problems, and they have.
North and South Vietnam, yes.
I'm sorry, I said Korea. Vietnam, thank you. I think that we have to begin to speak up, whether we're white-haired or no hair, or just so people, and make it known that we do not want another war. We do not need a war with North Korea, and it would be dangerous for all of us if we had such a war.
Let me just remind you, if you're just joining us, Connections broadcasting from the Little Theater with a live audience here as we get ready for PBS and WXXI-TV to roll out The Vietnam War, Ken Burns and Lynn Novick's 10-part, 18-hour series that takes a rather comprehensive look at Vietnam. You're hearing from Max and Henrietta Levine, who not only demonstrated against the war there, but sharing their feelings about that today, and also hearing from people who served. And I, Brother Weiss, I know you want to follow up there. What I want to do is let our audience know, in our second half hour, we're going to invite you up to microphones here and let our audience join the conversation. And I also want to let our engineer know, because we've got some wonderful people working in a lot of different places today. Rob Braden, the engineer, back in our studios on State Street. I'd like to listen to a clip from Nancy Bieberman on Vietnam. This is from one of the preview episodes that PBS has put out on the Burns and Novick series. Nancy Bieberman was also a protester. She talked about how her feelings have evolved a bit over time. And perhaps Max and Henrietta would disagree a bit, but let's listen to what Nancy Bieberman had to say about how her feelings have evolved from being a protester to now.
I've been to the wall more than once. When I look back at the war and, you know, think of the horrible things, you know, we said to, you know, vets who were returning, you know, calling them baby killers and worse. I feel very sad about that. I can only say that, you know, we were kids too, you know, just like they were.
So Nancy Bieberman, as a protester, I just want to ask you briefly, Henrietta, and then I'll ask our other guests to just to weigh in, and then we'll get to some audience comments as well. And Brother Weiss, you can certainly expand because I know you want to add there. But what she's saying is, I don't think she's saying she is disappointed in herself that she protested the war. But she looks back and feels badly at how personal it got for veterans who returned home. When we talk to people from Honor Flight and organizations now, it is amazing to me to hear the stories of veterans who go to Washington, who go to the wall, who come back now to the Rochester International Airport, and they have people applauding them, and they say, I never had that appreciation then. It was the opposite. I would just wonder, Henrietta, is there a way to kind of split the difference? Can we protest war in the macro without having individual veterans feel that personal animus? Or do you disagree with what you heard from Nancy Bieberman?
I don't disagree in that sense, but We wanted them to come home. We wanted them to say, no, I will not go, because we felt, and we still feel, this was an unfair war. We should not, the United States should not have been there.
Okay, Brother Weiss.
I just wanted to mention a few things. When Henrietta was talking about protesting and everything, I'm against the war, but I went three times for a juvenile reason that I had friends there, and I'm a guy, and I want to make sure I got to partake and take care of them the same way, even though I'm against the politics. But I also want to make sure that we meet Barry Culhane, that's sitting on the aisle over there in the yellow shirt, because Barry and Max Lill, the late Max Lill, are responsible for the Vietnam Veterans Memorial up in Highland Park. And I just want to say a quick anecdote. I was at the Veterans Outreach Center a couple of years ago, and some of my contemporaries that worked there and I went over to the memorial. It was my first time. And we walked through together, and I, every time I ran into a kid I went to high school with, and that's who was there, and I cried, and was really, I can't even say the real words on your lame radio show. So I said, I'm kidding. It's a wonderful show. But I was so angered that I would see this bollard with Mike Netterlich and all these kids I went to high school with whose lives were snuffed out at 19 and 20 years old for what I thought was a complete bullcrap reason. So it really, really politicized me, and I'm still waiting, and I respect the captain, but I just don't understand what we thought we were, you know. You come around here and everyone these days says, thanks for keeping us safe and all that stuff. But we're never literal. I didn't see any Vietnamese flying this way. I think this country was fine, and not only that, for the whole time I was in Vietnam, this country never skipped a beat. And I hate to use the word lost, but we didn't exactly win the war, and the country never changed. It was fine, yet 58,000 brothers perished at a very young age, and that's pretty angering. Parents lost their kids. Don't forget, that was the time of the draft. I actually enlisted, but because I was crazy. But anyway, I want to thank Barry for the memorial, because without them, it would be something, it would be a sin if we didn't have one here, and he's responsible, that's all.
All right, John, go ahead, sir.
Well, I just wanted to support the comment from the clip that the difference in the change, remarkable and dramatic for me, is that, as she mentioned, the terms baby killers worse, job applications that were rejected because they were afraid of your psychology after having been in Vietnam and been in a wartime environment. I believe that the change is we no longer hate the warriors, but you're allowed to hate the war. And so I don't mind the protesters that are against the war, but the difference today is we still honor and respect the warriors and those kids that go. The shame, I think, of the way we treated Vietnam vets when we all came back, it's an appropriate reversal that we see today.
So that, to you, a generation removed. As we talk about, you know, as Ken Burns and Lynn Novick has said, this is the time to try to learn those lessons. That's one of the big lessons to you?
That's a big lesson for me, and I think there's one more quick thing here as well.
Yeah.
Not necessarily advocating war, but if we're going to have them, and if we're going to be in a war, then I would suggest that we want the best trained, the highest quality of leadership on the ground and in the trench when we're there. And make no mistake, as a Marine Corps officer, yes, we're trained in terms of how to combat the enemy, but one of the other things, and I think you will find, the real honor of service is how you protect and save the lives of your comrades. And there are very, very few medals for heroism and for valor that are issued for how many enemy you killed or how many enemy you captured. Those medals are most often honored and awarded for saving the lives of your comrades. And so if you have good leadership, if you're in a war, let's try to save every life we can.
We need to take our only break of the hour, and we come back. If you want to join us, our audience in our nearly full little theater here, if you want to come up to the microphones, we'll take some audience comments and questions as we come back here on this live version from the little theater of Connections. Coming right back. Coming up in our second hour, from the veterans and the activists to the families in Vietnam who were displaced by the war, you're going to meet the Nguyen family, a family like so many others in Vietnam who had to decide in mere minutes, could they stay or was it time to go and leave everything behind? They left in 1975 protecting their own lives. Their life brought them to Rochester. We'll hear their experiences next hour. Welcome back to Connections. As we broadcast from the Little Theater with a live audience, we're having conversations about Vietnam as we get ready for WXXI-TV and PBS to roll out The Vietnam War, an 18-hour, 10-part documentary series coming your way from Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, September 17th. So Sunday night, 8 p.m., September 17th. We want to want you to join us on WXXI-TV for that. And then Sunday through Thursday, every night at 8 p.m. that week, the following week as well. It's a two-week event. We also want to mention that support for today's event is brought to you in part by Cobblestone Capital Advisors and Ferris Hills at Westlake. We appreciate that. And I want to let our audience know here in studio that in a moment we'll go to some of your comments. So if you're here and you want to join the conversation, your thoughts, your perspective, what you think we've learned in a generation since the Vietnam War, please get up and join us at a microphone. I'll tell you again who is with us in studio. You just heard Captain John White, a U.S. Marine Corps veteran, and Brother Weiss, the man who's known as Brother Weiss in this community, who is also a U.S. Army veteran, along with Henrietta and Max Levine, anti-war activists, sharing some of their perspective. Before we turn to some of the questions or comments here, I want to follow up and ask John a question, and we'll turn to our whole panel for this, but I'll ask our engineer, Rob, to get ready with a clip here. I want to listen to some of what we hear from Carl Marlantis, who is also a Marine. This is a comment that he made that you will see as part of the Vietnam War from Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. Let's first listen to what Carl had to say, and then we'll talk about it.
One of the things that I learned in the war is that we're not the top species on the planet because we're nice. We are a very aggressive species. It is in us. And people talk a lot about how, well, the military turns, you know, kids into, you know, killing machines and stuff. And I'll always argue that it's just finishing school. What we do with civilization is that we learn to inhibit and rope in these aggressive tendencies. And we have to recognize them. I worry about a whole country that doesn't recognize it. Because you think of how many times we get ourselves in scrapes as a nation because we're always the good guys. Sometimes I think if we thought that we weren't always the good guys, we might actually get in less wars.
John, what do you make of that remark?
I think that in a combat situation, you save lives on both sides by being swift and by being fierce. I think that holding back, being hesitant, costs a lot more than the political or the social issue of being nice. So I agree with that. I think that in Vietnam, we got a presidential order one time, a presidential level order that said we could not load our weapons until we were fired upon. Abject stupidity. And in order that, I don't know, Brother Weiss, how many of us complied with that order, but that was the type of attitude that politically came out of Washington, is to appease and to appeal to the social sense. But I would say on both sides of the war, swift and fierce saves a lot of lives.
Okay. Brother Weiss.
I can't lie. It's not good for radio, but I didn't hear what the person said because I'm deaf. But I will say that I always think of stuff when I hear of somebody else. My last tour in Vietnam, I was a door gunner on a helicopter. And we used to fly from Long Binh to Saigon to get our missions. And you couldn't even sit behind the guns. You couldn't even sit behind. We would sit in the passenger seat till we got to Saigon, and then we would get in our gunner seats and take our missions from there. And I don't know what the question was, but I was sitting here thinking, because the Levines are here, I did a couple really terrible things in Vietnam that I still have nightmares about. They were actually bad things to the enemy. And Alan Levine, their son, is over there, but I sent somebody a finger. And I remember Bobby, their son, Bobby Levine, took it from the guy I sent it to and buried it at Cobb's Hill, which I had never seen. And then it was, and you know, that it's nothing to be proud of. I'm sick over that but my mind isn't a normal mind. But that's just an ugly crap that could happen in this kind of place.
You still think about that?
Yeah, because it's so terrible.
Max, in this clip from the documentary series that we're going to see on PBS and WXXI-TV, you heard Carl Marlanta saying, you know, he thinks that aggression is part of the human condition. That is the opposite message we heard from an Iraq War veteran recently named Paul Chappelle, who came to speak on behalf of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence, who said that he believes that we have to train ourselves to be violent, that we are, that human beings are not naturally violent, and that war is not inevitable. Mm-hmm. How do you, so those are two very different ideas. As you think about your life in activism, who do you think makes the more compelling argument about whether war is sort of inevitable and human beings are naturally aggressive or violent?
War is is not an answer. I'm thinking back to the time when the CIA was in Laos and in Cambodia. We were not told that the CIA then was planning a war against North Vietnam. But the CIA was definitely responsible for the kind of hatred that had built up within the administration toward Vietnam. The CIA is responsible. You know, he said the person with the white hats or the dark hats. I don't think we should deserve anything that looked like a hat. We deserve better.
Let me go to one of the members of our audience. David has a comment to make there. Go ahead, David.
Yes, I'm David Dornfort with the Veterans for Peace. A question I have for the Levines. I heard about the people who could go to Canada. I heard about the people who could get a conscientious objective status, which was good. You know, it was, I think, a very unheralded group of people are those who chose to resist and go to jail. A high-profile case being John Baez's husband. And that's a group of people, I think, in the protest movement that were very unheralded and unrecognized. And maybe I would like a comment from you on that. Thank you.
Max and Henrietta, do you agree that when we think about, I think about my own family, probably like a lot of families. My father served, and another family member decided to be a conscientious objector and went to Canada. And I think that that split happened in so many families. But what David is saying is we don't spend as much time talking about people who were not conscientious objectors, but protested here and refused to serve here, even if it meant going to jail. Mm-hmm. Does that deserve more attention? What do you make of that?
Well, at that time, I think we couldn't do a lot about it. We, as a matter of fact, we had to recruit lawyers to train lawyers to be anti-war. I mean, they just didn't have that in their training, you know, and this was something that had to be done. Legal help for these young men who chose to go to war rather than go to war.
Go to jail.
Go to jail rather than go to war.
All right, well, let me tell the audience again. Oh, there's one over there. Gary, go ahead on the mic over there.
Well, first of all, thanks to WXXI and everybody for doing this at the Little Theater again. This is a great program. In piggybacking a little bit what Evan, you were talking about, Mr. Chappelle had talked about human nature and war. And I noticed that one of the panelists at one point really hesitated when it came to admitting that we lost the Vietnam War. And in fact, if you go on the internet, you'll see many sites will talk about how we won the Vietnam War. And what I'm wondering is, and I'm thinking a little bit of like, you know, Carl Jung's concept of common unconsciousness, that a culture can have a common unconsciousness. And we go back to the Vietnam era. I believe it was Johnson, President Johnson once said, well, I'm not going to be the American president to lose the first American war. But if you study American history outside of the United States, we clearly lost the War of 1812. And most Americans don't even recognize that. We have trouble admitting that we lost the Vietnam War. We have trouble admitting we lost the War of 1812. And what I would like to know, and a comment from the panelist, is if we have such a culture in America where we can't admit that we lost wars, how does then that affect us making decisions whether we're going to go to the next war?
Gary, thank you. Let's start with John White. Did we lose the Vietnam War, and does that impact our ability to kind of reason about future wars?
I was giving a speech in North Carolina several years ago. There was a Vietnamese gentleman in the audience. At the conclusion of the speech, a little Q&A time, my introduction included the fact that I was a Vietnam vet. He stood up, asked nothing about the content or the eloquence of my speech. He simply said, "Who do you think lost the war?" And I said, "Both of us." And I think from a perspective standpoint, as we go into these things and we take a look at, as Henrietta suggests, we look at Korea now, we look at Syria, we look at all of the problems in the Middle East, it's a very, very difficult thing to say who's going to and who will win. It's a loss on both sides.
Brother Weiss.
First of all, I think that everybody that died lost the war, and that's a damn shame. And I also like to say that I do know that this country can't lose, and Donald Trump definitely can't lose. But we can't lose, and I don't understand how you, if you're a sports fan, you can't say that Vietnam was a loss when the name of Saigon turned into Ho Chi Minh City. I don't know where the W and the L goes, but what's so terrible about the fact that we did a terrible thing and we did not come out with any kind of win, and 58,000 dead brothers. I'm never going to change my attitude about that. I understand the fact that people like Captain White has something inside. He went through a terrible, terrible time. So a lot of people can't do things like that and take the L, but it just seems like a fact to me, and it doesn't bother me.
But, Brother Weiss, I didn't hear John say we won the war.
No. He said both teams lost. I know how he feels, and I don't want him to feel any other way. But win and lost, as soon as you go, you're losing. And that's just the way I feel, and it's a terrible, terrible situation.
But does that mentality, that grappling with it, affect our ability to reason about whether to get into future wars?
I doubt it.
Apparently.
I wish it did.
Oh, you're saying
it did, but
it's not.
You're saying it should, but it doesn't seem to impact us.
We'll take a look around.
Okay. Max, if you can keep it tight, because we've got other comments we want to make, but you were reacting to some of what Gary had to say there. Go ahead. What do you think about this?
I don't have any strong feelings one way or the other, but the truth of the matter is we lost the war. We had someone in charge in Saigon who was directing the war for the president. He never, ever gave in to the idea that we had lost the war until the very end. And we've seen pictures on TV where they threw helicopters off of ships. The kind of hell that the Vietnamese were put through for those that wanted to leave Vietnam because the North were about to enter Saigon. We've seen the pictures time and time again. How can we say we did not lose that war? We did. And it's in our psyche somewhere that we can't lose the war. We're in a war for 15 years in Afghanistan, and the president feels now that we need more troops to win or not to win, to at least concede that we were there to be helpful for the Afghanistani people. It just boggles my mind that at a time and place where we're at a time and place when the president has made these remarks about North Vietnam, about other countries.
North Korea, yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
All right, let me turn to this mic. Jim, I think we have on this mic. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
First of all, I'd like to say I've never seen a stage full of more people I respect highly than this one, including you, Evan. Including you. This is a wonderful show, and you're a fantastic host. Both veterans have expressed a bewilderment in the roots of the war and why, and I'd just like to concur with Max when you opened the door to what you were talking about with the CIA, mm-hmm. that living in the age that we're living in now, in the information age, even though it seems like we can be overwhelmed, I cannot concur more from my own personal experience studying that there are answers to finding the roots of the war, and they go through that door.
Yeah.
And I couldn't agree more.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Jim, thanks for the comments there. Yeah. Anything you want to add there, Henrietta, to Max, to that?
No. The CIA goes back to historically to John Foster Dulles and his brother Alan under the Eisenhower administration when Arbenz in Guatemala was elected president. United Fruit in Boston asked the help of the government to overthrow a truly elected government, and they did. They sent the CIA in, and they overthrew Arbenz. The CIA was responsible for the overthrow in Iraq, in Iran, with who was the president of Iran at the time, Mossadegh, and put the Persian head back in power, Persian king back in power. We did it again in Indonesia, and we did it in Iran because Mossadegh was going to take the oil wells that were owned by British and Americans, mostly British, and he was going to, you know, he was going to change the formula of how they were going to be paid. And the British didn't do it, but the British asked Dulles to do it, and they did it.
Max, yeah. Let me just jump in. Keith has been waiting here, so let's got to keep it tight. We're down to our last couple of minutes. Thanks. Yeah. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you. And I would like to say thanks for allowing me to speak to this distinguished panel. And it's an honor to speak to you guys. And I would just like to say, in America, I see a lot of historical amnesia when it comes to violence, even though America was built on violence. Even our national anthem speaks of bombs bursting in air. And it's interesting, you know, that to create this empire of America, of the United States, it took violence. But we're not learning from the violent situations, and we're not implementing diplomacy on the higher level. It's a trickle-down effect of violence. Our institutions in this country have become overly violent, and it's a trickle-down effect. Our governmental system has promoted violence over peace.
And you don't see a lesson learned there, Keith.
And what I'm asking is, how can we, from the top level down, promote peace in our body politic? How can we bring and promote peace within our governmental institutions so that it can have a trickle-down effect to every sector of our society?
Thank you, Keith. We're in our last minute. To Brother Weiss, keep it tight. Short answer. Go ahead.
Short answer to that question?
Yeah, I know.
I don't have a short answer to the man's question. I don't think what he asked will ever happen in this country because, they have to play to the base, and half or more than half of this country thinks we should kill everybody that doesn't look like us, prays the same guy as us, or any of that stuff. So I doubt you're ever going to see anybody at the top talking about peace and love.
20 seconds, John, go ahead.
Just a final thought. Respect the warriors. Every prayer you have at the table, say, God bless those who stand the watch for freedom this night. And please understand, these young men and women, these brave and courageous young men and women, are doing the job we need them to do. They're very, very well trained. Regretful about war, but let's be trained to be there.
John, Brother Weiss, thank you both so much. And thank you both for your service as well to our country. I appreciate that. Max and Henrietta, thank you for sharing your perspective as well. Remarkable panel. Thanks. Much more from the Little Theater coming up next on Connections.